Welcome to the talkie bed. I want to acknowledge gratefully that we gather this morning on Treaty 1 territory. And for my part, I'm more and more conscious of the shared nature of my human experience. And that's sort of a big frame in some ways for what we're going to talk about this morning. But I feel like the more I learn about that aspect of our humanness, the shared nature of it, the more it hammers home inside of me the gratitude for being made welcome in a place, into an experience, whatever that might be. And that includes, as a person with colonial and settler ancestry, continuing to be made welcome here by those for whom this space was home before my ancestors arrived. It's lovely to be made welcome, and I to all of the First Nations and Indigenous folks that continue to do that, sometimes in very costly ways, thank you. Let's take a few moments to breathe together this morning. I've been reminded again this week by an acquaintance that working with our breath can be triggering, especially if we have trauma associated with breath. Similarly with being still. It's easy to sort of take one broad brush and go, isn't stillness lovely? Isn't it peaceful? Isn't that great? And that can all be true and also not be the case for everyone. And so maybe a long-winded way of saying, if this works for you, join in. If this doesn't, don't. Perhaps walking works better. Perhaps reading, perhaps writing. But whatever it is that can bring you and bring us together to a place of shared experience and attending to something together, I'd invite you to do that for the next few moments. We're going to breathe in a really simple way this morning, one that just is reflective of resting. So we fill up faster than we empty out physically. It takes us longer to blow all the breath out of our lungs than it does to fill up our lungs. And so we'll breathe in for a count of four. So through our nose, just a fill right up. One, two, three, four. And then out for a count of eight. All right. Through our mouths, pursed lips. So there's some back pressure. So if there was a candle there, we'd move the flame. So out for a count of eight. And we'll just do four rounds of that. In for four, out for eight. And if you want sort of a focal point, an idea focal point, let me suggest that it might be something along the lines of stillness or peace in the midst of whatever's swirling around. All right? Okay, here we go. Talking with one of our music making kids the other day about an experience they had with an instructor where they had played through a piece for them, and they have a really good, very substantial, trusting relationship with this instructor. It's quite beautiful. And at the end, the instructor said to them, "You played that entire piece with your shoulders up around your ears," and just sort of addressing the question of tension in our bodies when we're doing these physical, in this case, music-making things, but anything physical. All to say, part of my hope is in a breathing exercise like that, that you can feel, your shoulders, if they feel like they're metaphorically or actually up around your ears, you can sort of feel them coming down a little bit, and some of the stress and tension of life, the universe, and everything easing just a little bit for a few moments. Especially given that we're going to talk about something this morning that it's not awful or anything like that, but it's something that we might not think about all the time. And it starts with kind of us on our heels a little bit with the question, have you ever had one of those experiences where you just had to admit you were wrong about something? This is not a setup for a particular mea culpa on my behalf to the community or anything like that, at least not at the moment. I'm sure I'll have my moment for that, but I'm not talking about that, and I'm not talking about admitting we did something morally wrong, as in I should not have done that. But I'm talking about when we have to face having been factually wrong about something, as in that thing I believed, that's not true. Now, those might not be our favorite memories, because who really wants to be reminded of being wrong? But some of us, maybe especially those of us that are inclined to spouting off about what we believe, might not have to go back very far in our memories to find an occasion like that. I know that I don't have to go back very far to find an occasion like that. In our current cultural context, with issues often having their nuances functionally reduced by the formats in which they're communicated to us, you can't, to use one of my grandfather's folk sayings, you can't swing a stick without hitting someone that believes something different than you do. And sometimes those differences are about things that don't really seem all that amenable to being regarded as being in a gray area. Sometimes it seems like it's about pretty big ideas, things like, you know, the earth is round, kind of big ideas. Things that most people might call facts. Things that we might readily include in our list of what's true, whether we believe in it or not, in our list of what constitutes, or at least what points toward, reality. And we've been talking a lot about reality these past few weeks, and we've defined it in general terms as that which doesn't change, whether we believe in it or not, or which doesn't cease to be when we cease to believe in it, might be another way to say that. And it's implicit in that definition of reality that we might believe in things that are real, we might not believe in things that are real, and we might believe in things that are not real. Maybe I should say that another way. There's a lot of reals in there. How about this? Let's say that for our purposes, we could call what is real what is true. To believe in what is real is to believe in what is true. Not all of us believe the same things. So some of us, at least some of the time, believe some things that are not true. In fact, what we're increasingly coming to understand is that all of us, at least some of the time, believe things that are not true. So, perhaps an obvious question, I believe an important one, is how does that happen? How come people can believe things that we feel everyone should be able to see are true? And how come we can believe things that are not true? Well, there's an answer to that which is both remarkably simple, and it also takes a little bit of explaining. And by the way, I think this kind of information is important in our context because it helps people that are exploring what we believe, which is what this community is here to do. It helps us enter into that kind of process in what we might call spiritual frame of mind and heart. By which I don't mean a particular religious frame, even though I'm going to illustrate that idea from a particular religious frame. So if you grew up around the Christian tradition, you might recall a biblical text that says, "He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." Some of us can probably hum the, in many contexts, well-known melody that that text has been set to. The context for that little chunk of text is pretty fascinating. It's sort of like a stage play. It's the writer giving voice to the divine, so putting words into the mouth of the divine, if you will, in an imaginary court of law, a courtroom setting, in which God, the divine, is having to defend himself against people's accusations against him. So that's sort of the plot. It's one of those "thus saith the Lord" sorts of texts. You might remember a few weeks ago when I introduced the idea that "thus saith the Lord" is an ancient way of saying "thus saith reality," but with reality personified as God. And if you were wondering if that idea had any merit, and you grew up being taught that the last word on such a question might be found in sacred texts, then I would say it's worth checking out this passage in Micah chapter 6, and just asking yourself the question, in this text, who is the higher court of appeal? Because the higher court of appeal in the story is not the God character. It's the mountains. It's the hills. It's what the NIV translation calls the everlasting foundations of the earth. That's who the God character appeals to in their defense. In other words, the idea of God in that story is being measured against the reality of the world that the writer can see all around them. I'm not going to get into that in any further detail. I think we can just set that aside and sort of let it perk. Except to suggest this: walking humbly with our God is, seen through that lens, the equivalent of knowing our proper human place in reality, in the world that we can see and explore all around us. To do that, we've increasingly learned, we need to personify it. Not just by giving names to our ideas about the divine, but by doing essentially that same thing to all of reality. Because what we personify, we can love. And what we love, we are motivated to care about and care for, to nurture rather than to consume, to build up rather than to tear down. More about that another time. I wanted to mention that text because what I'm hoping to unpack a bit today is kind of, I'm going to say, kind of humbling stuff. It's a glimpse of reality that might take some of our self-understanding and relocate its center, probably by moving that center away from us as individuals and relocating it somewhat to community. A little aside here, as I was working on this, I was reminded that for some of us, at least in this community, I wanted to pause to say humbling is not the equivalent of shaming. Some of us grew up in religious settings where that got pretty muddled. To be humble is to have a clearer, more real understanding of our place in the world, whereas shame or shaming leads us to being more confused about what that right place might be. Very different destinations. Anyway, just a little pause button for that. Okay, to get into this, we need to back up into the history of human development a little ways. So as far as we can tell from what we've been able to gather from the information around us, the first skeletons of what archaeologists, paleontologists would call fully modern humans, by which they mean humans with the same brain formation and size as us. As far as we can tell from those skeletons, we reached this stage of fully modern humans in our evolution about 200,000 years ago. And so far, we have found no evidence that those first modern humans have any notions about anything beyond themselves. The biological, the neurobiological, the wiring, if you want a mechanical metaphor, that capacity for those kinds of ideas seems to have been there. That doesn't seem to have changed in ways that we can measure biologically, at least since then till now. But the other factors that might stir those kinds of thoughts into being don't seem to be firing yet. Takes about another 80,000 years or so for the beginnings of symbolic behavior to show up in the human record. And by symbolic behavior, the folks that study these things mean making things that are not utilitarian. Basically, making things that don't have a one-to-one ratio with survival. So in other words, at that point in human development history, we start to see evidence of our intelligence being used to make things that aren't just about food, shelter, fire, procreation of the species, or survival stuff. And a classic example of this is burials. And in particular, burials with grave goods in them. So now we got to kind of jump forward another 40,000 years or so to about 40 or 50,000 years ago, at which point in the record we find that modern humans are making many more symbolic objects. And this is also, there's an intriguing intersection here that I'm not going to take any time for, but this is also about the point in human history where, as a species, we leave Africa and we spread out from there across the rest of the planet. This is the point in human development history at which what archaeologists call impossible entities start to be depicted. And in archaeological language, impossible entities are things that don't occur anywhere in nature, things that don't refer directly to anything in the real world. So, for example, a figurine of a character that has the lower torso and legs of a human and the upper torso and head of a lion might be an example of what an archaeologist would call an impossible entity. And this is also the point in human history where magic and where spiritual themes start to be increasingly present in the art that humans are making. One interesting example I ran across of this was an example of bodies that were buried with ivory beads, these little carved beads that were handmade from tusks, from ivory. And one archaeologist, I can't remember what this discipline is called. I think it's called practical archaeology. I think, I'm not sure, could be wrong about that, but or experiential, but they where they actually kind of tried to do the thing that they found to get a grip on what it would have involved. And he went to carve one of these ivory beads and then just sort of measured how long it took to carve one, and then thought about that in terms of how many beads were in the burial site and what sort of labor that represented, what sort of value. And these are bodies that are buried with thousands of ivory beads, which represent, because it takes about half an hour at least, if you're good, to carve one of those, thousands of hours of labor, of human value. And so by this, we would come to understand that at this stage in human history, humans are now imagining a life beyond this one, sort of for the first time, as far as we can tell. And they're starting to imagine that life as having value, hence being worthy of valuable things going with the departed person into that hereafter. Now, in some ways, we could understand this as the point where we as a species have developed the capacity to imagine a reality that is something bigger than what we can see or know through our senses, a spiritual world, if you will. It's a world of beliefs in which many different beliefs are possible. Not all of those beliefs are going to be true in the sense of true that we were talking about a few moments ago. So at this point in human history, as a species, we find ourselves with options about what to believe. And along with that comes the increased possibility of believing things that are not true, which, as we can tell at a glance these days, is something we're pretty susceptible to. So, here's the question that comes to my mind out of that, at least in our context today. What makes us so susceptible to believing things that are not true? Here's the basic premise behind the perspective from which we'll explore that for the next few minutes. There are, of course, other available perspectives. What makes us so susceptible to believing things that aren't true? As individuals, we don't know enough to justify almost anything that we believe. For example, we believe that the Earth revolves around the sun. We would say this is a basic fact, generally widely accepted. But probably there is not one of us that can explain the astronomical observations that support that belief. Here's the really significant implication of a perspective like that, which is primarily based in what we now know about our neurology and our neurobiology. Most of what we believe is not based on the knowledge we store in our heads. Most of what we believe is not based on what we know and carry with us in our heads. Because in terms of stored knowledge, there's not actually that much in there in terms of storing detailed information. This is a huge field of study. It's moved a long ways in the last 50 years, even I would say. There was a time not very long ago in neurobiology where the mechanistic model for the brain was the prevailing one. In company with that, a computing model for the brain that our brains function like computers. Both of those, and there's also a hydraulic one in that history. Those have all sort of fallen out of favor as we've learned more about how our brains function. And so, as part of that exploration, in the 1980s, there was a study done by a psychologist named Thomas Lamure. And he set out to estimate, so this would maybe be almost sort of at the zenith or just past the zenith of this idea of our brains as a computing device. He set out to estimate in bytes the size of an individual's knowledge base. And I won't go into the details of the study, but basically what he did is he used the data that he gathered to estimate the rate at which we acquire knowledge and also the rate at which we forget what we learn. And then he extrapolated that to a 70-year lifespan, and his estimate is that we can store about 1 gigabyte worth of knowledge in our head. For $14 on Amazon, I can get a memory stick that holds 64 gigabytes. Anyway, here's the main way that this perspective might explain the gap between what we think is happening between our ears and what is actually going on. This study, this the video that I saw from this study just cracked me up, but it also kind of rocked me. A study was by a psychologist named Michael Tomasello, a bit of a guru, a contemporary guru in this field of study. And in the video clip that I saw, a researcher kind of walks into the room, and the room, there's a cabinet, like a sort of an armoire, like a closed storage cabinet on one side, and in the corner where they can see everything that's going on, there's a mom sitting with a young child, maybe, I don't know, I'd say maybe like a three-year-old or something like that. And no words are exchanged. There's no written exchange of information. It all happens sort of in relative silence. Researcher walks into the room kind of hunched over carrying an armload of books. And they walk up to the cabinet, which is closed, and they kind of bump into it. And they kind of back away because they can't get in. And they try it from another angle and they bump into it. And then nothing else happens. And they go at a third angle and they kind of bump into it. And at this point, the kid who's been watching all of this hops up, walks across the room, opens the cabinet doors, and looks up at the researcher like, see, like, just now, just put them in there. The door is open. I got this. You got this, you know, and that's sort of how the clip ends. Oh, my word. Hilarious to watch. Absolutely fascinating, because what happens, and again, all of this is happening without the benefit of any spoken or written words being exchanged. What's happening is collaboration. What's happening is sharing knowledge and working together to solve problems. Human kids, even little kids, even nonverbal kids, can master that complexity easily. Here's the short version of the takeaway. Thinking and knowing, we are growing to understand, are social processes. They are generated by interaction with those around us. We talked about this a few weeks ago when we considered some of Nancy L.M. Abrams' work in the New Science of Emergence, when we talked about her her book called A God That Might Be Real. I think was the title. This is sort of the idea in broad terms. We each have our own little slice of knowledge, our own, you know, little gigabyte. Our brains, we probably would be best off not comparing them to information retrieval and storage devices, because it's actually not the way that they function. They process an enormous amount of information, but don't store very much. And they are built to collaborate. Our minds are made to share knowledge. And that allows us to pursue incredibly complex goals collectively, despite not having all that much stored in there, and despite none of us having anything even approaching the knowledge to understand or explain all of what we're doing or what we're encountering. A material example might be a structure like the Milan Cathedral. Look that one up. You may love or despise the architecture. It's hard to be indifferent about it because it's so... just go look at it. There's lots of moving parts. But that building took 600 years to build. It wasn't officially done, I think, until the late 60s. It had 75 chief engineers, thousands of workers. No one person ever had anything approaching the grasp of the whole. And yet here is this quite remarkable structure. Collaboration for us as a species is how we do great things. Now, there's also a bit of a dark side or a shadow side to this. Because we're evolved to draw on knowledge that is outside of our own heads without even thinking about doing it or being especially aware that we're doing it, sort of the three-year-old opening the cupboard door for the researcher without them ever communicating verbally about it. Because of that, it's easy for us to fail to recognize the limits of our own understanding. It's hard for us to perceive this limitation of ourselves because it's not the experience that we're having. There's a cognitive scientist named Stephen Sloman and has a recent study, had two groups in this study, one of which he told about some just absolutely, you know, fictitious, completely made up science about this recent discovery of some glowing rocks. And then he told the group that the scientists who'd made this discovery did not know what made the rocks glow. And then he asked them, how well do you understand? And no big surprise here, really. They said they had no clue. And that was consistent with what they actually knew about the rocks, which was, you know, nothing. And the other group in this study was also told about the glowing rocks. So same information in that regard. But then they were told that the scientists had discovered exactly how the rocks glow. Full stop. And now, when Sloman asked the participants how well they understood, they claimed to understand the rocks a bit better themselves, even though he had told them absolutely nothing about how they glowed. They knew equally little about the rocks as the first group, but they talked as if whatever knowledge the scientists ostensibly had about the rocks had been transmitted directly to them. That's pretty interesting. It seems like we're inclined to believe that having access to knowledge is the same thing as having knowledge. It's as if knowledge is like, I use this illustration with reluctance at one level, it's like knowledge is like a virus. It's like knowledge is contagious, like we can catch it from somebody else and have it for ourselves. But here's the important intersection. So first of all, that's not the way it works in terms of what we carry with us, right? But here's the dark side part of that intersection, if you will. When you combine an idea like contagious understanding, a misperception like contagious understanding, with individual ignorance, not knowing, the resulting mixture can be toxic. The danger, one way to talk about it, is that the danger is that I might express a strong belief because I feel like I understand something. But that sense of understanding is false. It's something that I've sort of vacuumed up from those around me expressing strong beliefs because they feel like they understand that something. But their sense of understanding comes from those around them, and so on. So remember what I said about that gigabyte storage system of ours? Think about it this way. None of us, as an isolated unit, knows enough to know what's true or what's false. None of us, as an isolated unit, knows enough to know what's true or what's false. And yet, we do not feel that way. We feel like we do know enough to stand firm on the beliefs we espouse, the views that we hold. From this point of view, it's not that hard to see how entire groups of people can come to believe things that aren't true. It's a lot of work to actually seek verification for something we claim to believe, or are inclined to believe, or are considering as a belief, to actually take those beliefs apart, to consider other points of view, to explore them. It's the work of a lifetime, really. Let's take some of those ideas and just plug them into our lived experience for a moment. How does this work when we encounter someone that believes something different than we do? Because that happens sometimes, right? Now pick a news item. Pretty much any news item, or at least any polarizing news item. Okay, pick any news item. Or even just have a life that includes people that are not from our like me group when it comes to beliefs. Given that most of us think or have the experience that we have arrived at what we believe by virtue of independent thinking, that our ideas are actually our ideas, the product of serious independent consideration and analysis, or that we can support and justify what we believe based on what we know, the obvious conclusion when we meet someone that doesn't believe what we believe is that they are just too much of a muddlehead to see the truth. Perhaps they're stubborn, perhaps they're willfully blind, or maybe they're just not that bright. To some degree, that is correct. The painful part to consider is that it might be correct about them, but not any more than it is correct about us. We're all pretty adept at sorting the sound bites we're surrounded by, selecting the ones that work for us, maybe giving them a little bit of a tweak so they feel like our words before we spit them back out as evidence of what we know, of our position, of what we believe. Now, when you think about it this way, which you may or may not do, of course, but when you think about it this way, all of us hold what we might call false beliefs. The beliefs we hold as individuals are, by virtue of the limitations of the holders themselves, us as individuals, those beliefs are necessarily incomplete or based on a very small sample of the information that underpins them. Now, we need to make decisions about what we believe to live, of course. Taking some perspective on issues or events helps us to function. Holding those perspectives as though they were completely informed or fully considered is, in itself, a kind of ignorance about how we function as human beings. Seen through the lens of this kind of perspective, whenever we express our beliefs, we're basically serving as a conduit for our communities of knowledge. Knowledge, as we hold it as humans, is shared. We are, and I would suggest are increasingly aware as we become more conscious of the impacts of our interconnectedness, sort of like one big brain. The world is way too complex for any one of us to understand. Most of the individual issues are too complex for any one of us to understand. As Sloman and his co-author in this particular case, another neuroscientist, or neurobiologist rather, named Philip Fernbach, as these authors suggest in their book called The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone, as a species, we can build hugely complex societies and hugely complex technologies, and as individuals not know how a pen or a toilet works. You know, these sort of basic everyday things. Now, at a quick glance, that could seem like a reason to sort of throw up our hands, retreat to positional thinking, post vitriolic responses to whomever doesn't share our perspectives. You know, sort of a familiar response to you're not seeing the world the way I am. But even a little consideration might reveal another quite lovely possibility. As humans, this perspective and this research suggests that it seems we're made to thrive in the midst of this kind of complexity. And although the neurobiologist's perspective and other sort of scientific perspectives on this is a continually sort of emerging field of study, this idea at its sort of human roots is one that the sages have seen from far before it was being measured using the methods of contemporary science. And when I look to the sages because of my own history, and my own traditions, I tend to look to the Hebrew sages and their work. And when I look there, I find ideas like this: where there is no counsel, the people fail. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. One big brain. Listen to advice and accept instruction that you may gain wisdom in the future. If you want to look them up there in Proverbs 11 and Proverbs 19. Huh, how about that? Wisdom, which is what those proverbs are referencing as the good outcome of shared knowledge. Wisdom, as the dictionary defines it, is knowledge and the ability to make due use of it, to plug it into life, skill for living. When it comes to walking humbly with our reality, with our God, to use the ancients' word for that which does not depend on us for its existence. When it comes to walking humbly with our reality, we could do worse than starting with the knowledge that knowledge itself is a collective reality, that none of us is equipped to hold what we need in our own heads, but rather that we need one another, even to answer a question as seemingly simple as, what do you know about that? Curiosity and connection with others is going to carry us much further in the direction of knowing our proper, our true place in reality than individual knowledge ever will. And also, that curiosity and connection as a process can contribute to a kinder, more consciously interdependent world in the process. In the context of the table and what we exist in the world to do together, that feels like a really hopeful set of ideas to me. It feels like, pulled together, they suggest that we should keep on exploring what we believe, not as isolated individuals, but together. Because that's how we know things anyway. That's where I'm going to leave that for today. Peace to you all. And also some joy. as we keep exploring together. These are things I hope for and work for.